Amitava Kumar is a novelist, poet, journalist, filmmaker, and Helen D. Lockwood Professor of English at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie. He is the author of A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb and Nobody Does the Right Thing, a novel. His new book, A Matter of Rats, a short biography of Patna, is an entertaining account of his hometown. His ruminations on one of the world's oldest city, the capital of India's poorest province, are also a meditation on how to write about place. His memory is partial. All he has going for him is his attentiveness. He carefully observes everything that surrounds him in Patna. Rats and poets, artists and politicians, a girl's picture in a historian's study, and a sheet of paper on his mother's desk. The new book is published by Duke University. It is a beautiful book, and it's a pleasure to welcome Amitava Kumar to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The old adage being you can't go home again. So what is it like to write about a place that you come from?
It is partly a return to who you were at that time. So it's about the place, but it's also about yourself, how you've changed. And for me, it was a lot also about taking measure of who I was at that time, how my friends have changed, what they have become, what are the things I did not know at that time about them and also about the place.
So give us the timeline. You lived there for how long?
Till my early 20s.
Okay. So the first quarter of one's life, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then, did you return to write the book or did you do it from memory?
I returned to write the book, but I had been going back each year.
Anyway. Once a year. Yeah.
Yeah.
And at what point did you decide, okay, I want to write about this place, to make that conscious effort that you want to write about that place?
Yeah. In several of my books, I had mentioned Patna, but this was a publisher's idea, a start of a series on Indian cities. And he asked me to write about my hometown. That was the first book in the series in India. And then I later signed it with Duke also. So he asked me, and I thought of the rats that had carried away my mother's dentures. And the reason I thought of that was also because...
How would you not think of that?
Yes. Right. And then I had read in the newspaper a police commissioner saying that we are tired of these rats. They are drinking all the confiscated liquor in our police station. And I thought, you know, people will hear that about Patna and say that's a Patna story. In India, certainly. But I wanted to exploit it in order to say, I am the rat who has left Patna, who has left his, you know, aged parents there. So I wanted to exploit almost a stereotype of Patna, of its backwardness, in order to seduce the reader and tell a little story about the self, you know, about myself having, as I said, abandoned my own past.
Because you asked that question in the book a few times of who is the rat now?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. When you think of this place, as I mentioned in the introduction, it's India's poorest province. It's the capital city.
Yes.
So it's a large city.
It is.
Does that make it multifaceted?
Yes. It also makes it multifaceted in the sense that it has such a varied history. You know, one of the first, you know, the Buddha, it is said, predicted that this would be a great city, and it rose to be a great city. It was the capital of the first, what one might call, Indian Empire. Various major religions arose there, Buddhism, Jainism. But it's also a place of great degradation. So it's varied in that sense of its history, but varied also in the sense of various communities living there. You know, large Muslim population, large Hindu population, obviously, other communities. One of the last Sikh guru was born there. So multifaceted in that sense, yes.
You write in the book that as you found your footing as a writer, you looked for Patna in literature.
Yes.
And other than an occasional glance, there wasn't a whole lot.
Yes.
Which is interesting, given what you just said, of its rich history.
Yes. In contemporary literature, certainly in dominant contemporary literature in India, it is English writers who are on the forefront. You don't find many of them in Patna. There's only one other writer and I who have been writing in English about Patna. So in Urdu, in Hindi, you do have writers. And so in some ways, I should correct that presentation and say, in other languages, there is a presence of Patna. But for those who speak and write in English, and that is what we know here, we don't have that.
Does that put a pressure on you then, that you are really the scribe of this place?
Yes, but only if I think so much more about the West. I should tell you very quickly that the other writer I mentioned, his name is Siddharth Chaudhary. He asked about a previous book of mine, whether I was, you know, he congratulated me, and I said, well, I'm just waiting to hear from my agent if it will be published in the West, you know, in New York and London. And he said, why? Why should you worry? Does Paul Auster worry about whether his books are read in Patna?
Mm.
And for me, unlike my friend, I want to say, well, I would like Paul Auster. I would like other American writers to know about my town. In the same way as people in my town, or people in India in general, know more about Philip Roth and John Updike.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So if we are indeed living in a globalized world, how about introducing some equality into that world, about how we, equality in terms of perception and knowledge of each other.
Do you feel, and I was actually just talking to my wife about this over the weekend, it seems to me that our literature has become much more globalized. It seems like we have gotten better about that. Most of the new literate novels, of what we would say literature, much of it has an international scope and basis. And I find that to be fascinating and quite frankly refreshing.
Yes. Literature, like rats, has been carried from one part of the world to the other. In trade, you know, people travel.
Yeah.
Books travel.
Yeah.
I think books travel sometimes a little better in every direction than people do, because a poor guy from a small town in India will not be permitted to enter Europe or the US without a proper visa, which is determined from certain calculations. But a book he or she writes can indeed come a little bit more easily, I think, especially if it is in English.
That's fascinating. They have rights that the writer does not have.
I think so. And don't you think?
Yes.
Yes.
But also, there's something to be said then for those of us in the West.
Yes.
And vice versa, I would assume, that are welcome to those stories and wanting to know about Patna and wanting to know about the people who came from there and the people who live there.
Yeah, this is the place where I thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you.
My wife listens to you every day on her way to work to SUNY Newport.
Well, that is that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when you, in reading the book about the place, it's and I don't mean this in any critical sense, but sometimes it's tough to feel to know whether it is with love or regret or disgust.
Ah, very good point. That's a good observation. Yes, I don't know. I don't want to be drawn surrender to nostalgia,
mm-hmm.
because nostalgia often seems to be the purview of a certain kind of nationalist. You know, someone who says India is great, or India had great glory in the past. Or my story, or my town is wonderful. It had a certain magnificence in another millennium. I don't want to be drawn by that. I wanted actually to question myself, how honest would I be in writing about a place to which I had attachment, but I would also be honest about my observations. So I have written about a poet, for example, and his marriage. I admired his poetry. Mm-hmm. I thought his marriage was messy. And something about his poetry, as well as his marriage, told something about my town. I thought I was betraying a friendship. But I had decided from quite early on that was going to be my stance. Can I read you a few lines about what guided me there?
Mm-hmm.
I recently read an interview with the Irish writer Colm Tóibín. Tóibín had told a class he was teaching that you have to be a terrible monster to write. Everything is material, the writer was saying. Even confidences that someone has indiscreetly shared with you. Tobin's advice to writers was to go ahead and use the story, even if readers were going to identify the person you were writing about. the writer's credo must be, use it, because it will make a great story. Tobin had said, if you can't do it, then writing isn't for you. You have no right to be here. If there's any way I can help you get into law school, then I will. Your morality will be more useful in a courtroom. So I was prepared to, in some ways, write even about that poet who is my friend, about the things he had said, about what his wife had said, and lay it out. And I thought that was going to be my stance. So the sort of mix of emotions that you're seeing there is my desire to lay open also my ambivalence about surrendering to nostalgia or being necessarily faithful to only one emotion.
The other part of that, of what Tobin is saying, and I think that it can be interpreted, is because I've heard this argument as well, whereas, but if it impacts you, it is then your story.
Ah, yes, yes, I see what you say. Yes, yes, yes. And I was quite prepared that I was not going to present a picture of the place in terms of municipal records, or say what the population is, right. Have things changed, is the health situation better, how many eggs get imported into the town every day. I was going to write, for example, about how I feel when I say goodbye to my parents, mm-hmm. You know, and what does that place mean in terms of one's childhood's association, and then the feeling of guilt about leaving your parents or your roots.
And as a result, the book has a dreamlike quality to it, in the sense of that it lingers in and comes in and out.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah.
And which I would say is fairly representative of much of your fiction, right?
Yes, I think the difference between a journalist and a writer, and I have affiliations with both those professions.
Yes.
Is that a journalist is reporting without that kind of mix of interior reflections, that movement into dreams and nightmares, into feelings that a writer does. So therefore, the writing will be a little bit, will have what you're calling a more dreamlike quality to it.
Right.
Talking of dreams, I end the book by talking about what it means to think of my parents and saying goodbye. I went home to Patna a few months ago in early January after my mother died. And the night of her funeral, I woke up with a sharp pain in my finger. A rat had bitten me, you know. And I wrote that night to my literary agent and asked her if it was a form of literary criticism. But of course, I was also worried. And my friend Seth Vassar, my colleague, he saw, quickly wrote back and said, no, all you need is a tetanus shot, yeah, and which is what I got in the morning. So there is the dreamlike quality, and then there are the sharp incisions in your skin, literal or metaphorical.
And it should be noted, so January, this book is done at that point, right?
Yes.
So, but you, so you cannot, I mean, I wouldn't be able to get that out of my head, that was meant to be in some way, shape, or form.
Yes, yes. Can I read another paragraph?
Please.
I talk about a BBC documentary on YouTube.
Yes.
The gentleman steps off the boat, and he says how in 300 BC, the Greeks had described this place as a spectacular, the greatest city in the world. And I go on with that and I say, I felt pride when I heard that. But I have to admit that my view of history is not so grand. In fact, it is rather narrow and is measured in days, at most months, and seldom years. There is no way to avoid it. When I step on Patna's soil, I only want to see how much older my parents look. Rheumatoid arthritis has seized my mother's limbs, and she finds it impossible even to comb her hair. My father's memory is as sharp as it has always been, certainly better than mine, but the contours of his body have begun to sag. He goes for a walk each morning, but I noticed last time that he was limping. I arrive in Patna, and a few days later I leave. Each time I leave, I wonder about the circumstances under which I will need to return. Mm-hmm. So yes, I put the book to bed and I remain with a thought. I wondered whether I'd see my mother again.
And that is a universal feeling, obviously. I think where obviously you have the you're talking about the place and also your mother, but that feeling when you lose a parent or lose parents, that your connection to that place, the connection, because they're the clearinghouse of information. They're the clearinghouse of information. Sure. for you on that city, on your family, of what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. And when they're gone, then it's either up to you or it just goes away. And I think when my parents left, I felt, well now I don't, like, I don't, all those questions that you have to ask, you have no one really to ask.
Yes.
Them
yes,
to anymore.
Yes.
And that's a really weird feeling.
Yes. There's an Indian journalist who, like you, is very popular on radio, and he said to me that another thing that changes is that all your achievements now are meaningless. They're only for you. Now, because everything you were trying to do was trying to tell something to your parents, and now all of them are meaningless. And that's another thing that struck me, that I do not... I'm doing something for my children, certainly.
Mm.
But that sense of why, that sense of meaning in some ways has lost a continent to which it adhered before, to which it was anchored. But yesterday we celebrated Mother's Day, and coming back to what you were saying, I wonder how many of us asked our surviving parents or our parents some questions.
Mm.
Like, what was it like?
Yes.
Who was I at that time? Who were you before you had me?
Right. It's an interesting point about so much of what we do is in a form of a presentation to our parents. I think about in our family culture that my mother would often take any article or anything that mm-hmm. any achievement and it would go into the Bible, you know.
Wow.
And then the Bible was just filled with all the stuff from all of, we were five of us, so it was just chock full. And the other day I got something and I thought, oh well, now there's no like place to put, like, where do you put that?
Now
what do you do with this?
Yes.
And it doesn't have the legitimacy. It's sort of like, you know, when you're an adult, you don't have summer vacation, doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yes.
Well, you're a professor, it does. But for us...
That's a lovely image, the Bible.
Yeah.
Full of family memories.
Right. And it's sort of a collection. I mean, you go in there and you find sort of everyone's achievement of knowing what's going on. Do you... So you still... Do you think you'll still go back? Your father is still...
Yes, my father is there. Yes, yes. I will go back, but with a sense of diminishment.
Mm.
You know, something has been cut. One thing I wanted to say, in terms of what you said, your mother saved and put in the Bible. I was writing a novel and I thought I would ask my parents a little bit. With my father, I have always had a very formal relationship.
Right.
But I had a tape recorder, I put it out there and asked him, and he gave me dates, he's very precise. I asked my mother too about her marriage, her first night. She met my father on the day she got married to him. And she gave me a few very vague details. But when I came back to America, I found in the book that I was reading a letter. And that letter was a letter that my father had written to my mother just a few months after their marriage. And there was her answer to me. And I thought that was a very generous gift. You know,
wow.
The generosity of parents who transcend all their natural reticence and make you an offering because they are thinking of you, that you are a writer, you want to do something with their lives. So thank you, Mom.
How did you acknowledge it?
I put it in my novel and I gave that novel to her. I changed some things, but I gave it to her. But I was too shy, or just did not know how to ask her whether she had read it.
Yeah, because there's always a reticence,
I guess,
to know.
Yes,
and sometimes
yes.
You may not want to know.
Yes, exactly, 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 exactly.
So that's a beautiful way, artistic way, of doing it in both cases.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, certainly in her case, yes.
You were talking a moment ago about being both, I mentioned both novelist and poet and journalist and filmmaker and all of these fields. Will you, I assume... There's always a novel in you.
Yes. Yes. I'm writing one, yes. I'm also at the same time teaching a journalism course at Vassar, so I want to keep my reportorial instincts sharp.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing both those things. I'm pursuing a story.
What do you like reporting on?
The ordinary things that surprise you. One thing in our region, for example, maybe 6-7 years ago, I found in the New York Times a picture of a row of toothbrushes. And it said it was from a psychiatry hospital in Poughkeepsie that was now closed down.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yes. You can imagine a psychiatry hospital, but this row of toothbrushes, you know, adults' toothbrushes all in a row for someone else to give out to each one or something. That's such a more surprising thing, you know. So I'd like to write about the ordinary, but what is startling about the ordinary, if I can get that. So, for example, in this book, I heard that Napoleon's bed is in my town. I wanted to know, how did Napoleon's bed come to my town? You know, in a gym in Florida, I found the story that the best opium came from my town. Well, does the best opium still come from my town? Stuff like that.
And those are questions that you want to ask.
Yeah, Marlon Brando was there in 1967.
That's right.
What was Marlon Brando doing? I wrote it in a piece in the New York Times about that. And then a gentleman from here, near Woodstock, wrote and said, I saw him there. He headed a famine relief agency. His name is Larry Holzman.
Yep.
He was heading a famine relief agency, CARE in Patna, and saw Marlon Brando.
The book is just beautiful. Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
Beautiful.
Thank you, sir.
It is A Matter of Rats, a short biography of Patna, and it is published by Duke University Press. Amitava Kumar, I thank you so much for sharing with us. What a delight to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm a regular listener of this radio station, so it's great.
Well, thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.